So, good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is John Piggott. I'm the director of the ARC Centre of Excellence in Population Ageing Research, an entity that we call CPAR. And it's great to be able to welcome you all here this evening, where we're going to have the pleasure of hearing Professor James Nasrou from the University of Manchester talk about inequality in later life and what the impact that has on health and well-being. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Bedigal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, and pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island people who are here today. So tonight's event is hosted by CPAR in partnership with the UNSW Grand Challenge on Inequality. CPAR is funded by the Australian Research Council under their Centres of Excellence program, and it focuses on research dealing with the challenges of an ageing demographic, both in Australia and globally, and also developing new researchers with a multidisciplinary appreciation of the issue. It's based here at the University of New South Wales, but is really a national centre. It has nodes at the ANU and the University of Sydney, University of Melbourne, and the University of Western Australia. The Grand Challenge Program, the UNSW Grand Challenge Program, has been established to facilitate critical discussions on the biggest issues facing humanity, and in this process raises awareness of the kind of research, the kind of groundbreaking research and initiatives that are undertaken by UNSW, its academics, its professional staff, and its students. The Grand Challenge on Inequality was launched in 2017 and is led by Professor Roslyn Dixon and Professor Richard Holden. It's focused on conversations around poverty, around inequality, around economic disadvantage, and how they interact. Richard, who is here tonight, will convene the Q&A after the talk. Some of you may be aware that, like Professor Nasrou, our President and Vice Chancellor, Professor Ian Jacobs, has spent quite a lot of time at the University of Manchester. So it's with great pleasure that I invite Professor Jacobs to introduce James Nasrou to you this evening.
Thank you, John. Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. In fact, it is a real pleasure for me to be here for at least three reasons. One, of course, is to reflect on the great work that CPAR has done under the leadership of John and his colleagues. The second is because our Grand Challenge program at UNSW is genuinely important to us. And one of those grand challenges that we're looking at is, of course, inequality. And thanks to Richard and Ros and everyone else involved in that for their great work. And, of course, I know James from my time in Manchester, so that's my third reason for being delighted to introduce this talk. And I want to start by acknowledging the Bedigal people, not just because that is something that we always do at meetings like this at UNSW, but because it is critically important in the context of a talk that we're going to hear on the topic of inequality. James is well known to the staff of CPAR, given his role as a partner investigator. And I met James when we both worked at the University of Manchester. I came to UNSW from Manchester 3.5 years ago. And when I was there, I was in the Faculty of Medicine, I was Dean of Medicine, and I was incredibly impressed by the way in which James, his work, and the work of his team made a link, a cross-disciplinary link, between the humanities and medicine and science and health. It really was a very impressive aspect of the work in Manchester, and James had an enormous, and does still have an enormous impact in Manchester and much further afield. As James may tell us, there's an element of governments across the world playing catch-up on ageing policy. Perhaps that's especially the case in the UK, in Asia, and Australia. It's an area that one could argue has been badly neglected, despite warnings that the scales were going to tip for some time. For Australia, the government's first intergenerational report in 2002 painted a picture of our population in 2042. Lower birth rates, lower death rates, subsequent projected pressures on the budget, and I'm not really qualified to say, but I don't think that much was done at that time to address it. The 2015 intergenerational report stated that Australians will live longer and continue to have one of the longest life expectancies in the world. The report projected that in 2054 to 55, life expectancy at birth will be 95 years for men and almost 97 years for women. There'll be around 40,000 people age over 100 compared to just 122 in 1975. All of that presents enormous challenges and maybe some opportunities, but certainly it's a complex challenge given the determinants of inequality are complex themselves. Income, class, education, gender, ethnicity, mental health and physical health, to name just a few. I think that here in Australia we can learn a lot from Manchester. Manchester has its own problems, but it is a city that was recognised as age-friendly in the 2010 World Health, in 2010 by the WHO. And that's only come about because of its cutting-edge approach to collaboration across all sorts of ideas and areas that ageing touches on. The age-friendly Manchester programme is highly regarded because of the creative partnerships that have proved so effective. The unique relationship it's forged with the Universities of Manchester and Salford and their Dementia Action Research Programme, and of course the Manchester Institute for Collaborative Research on Ageing, of which James is co-director. James is also quite a few other things. His work is inspirational. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Manchester. He's lead investigator for the six-year interdisciplinary research program, Frailty, Resilience and Inequalities in Later Life. He's a chief investigator on the ongoing English longitudinal study of ageing. He's a partner investigator on an ARC discovery grant, Socioeconomic Determinants and Health Inequalities Over the Life Course, which is being conducted in collaboration with CPAR investigators. So, all in all, James is superbly qualified to talk on the topic of inequality in later life, the impact on health and well-being, and it's my sincere pleasure to introduce to you Professor James Nasrou. Welcome, James.
Thank you very much, Ian and John, and to you all for coming to listen to me. When Ian said I was many things, I'm glad he just stuck to my work roles. I thought he might move beyond my work roles to other things that I might be, but I'm glad to say he didn't. It's really a great pleasure to be here and a great pleasure to be engaged with CPAR, which is one of the world-leading centres on ageing. And one which I think we around the world are very happy to watch and to collaborate with where we can. You'll have heard a little bit about the Manchester context from Ian, and I think it's very nice that he gave that recognition. Manchester is a very exciting place to be if you're studying ageing, partly because of the local policy context, where the local city council is driving this age-friendly agenda. And so with the support of the WHO, and so that enables us to do lots of things in terms of practice that that academics often don't get the chance to do. I'm probably one of those academics who's less engaged in practice, and you'll gather that from when you get to the end of my talk, when I talk about policy, which is more theoretical than real. But nevertheless, it is a really important part of what we should be and need to be doing. So, I'm going to talk about inequalities in later life. My talk is about ageing. And I'm going to start off by just saying a little bit about how I conceptualize the issue of aging in contemporary societies and how I think we might approach it. I'm then going to try and talk about the centrality of inequality to understanding aging processes and why inequality is so important. A little bit about mechanisms that relate to what happens to us in later life that drive these inequalities. And then talk about why I think class is a central concept here, why studying class allows us to really get to grips with the mechanisms of inequality in later life. And then finally, I'll say something about policy, but as I've indicated, I'll probably say something relatively brief about policy in this context. So I'll start off with the kind of introduction that Ian just gave about aging societies. And what I have here is a quote from 1999, an emerging commission on global aging produced in one of their preliminary reports that identifies aging in developed countries as a core issue. And of course, it's not just aging in developing countries that's the core issue, it's aging around the world that's the core issue, and indeed aging in developing countries that presents us with some very big challenges. But they identify the change in the human life cycle and the need to preserve economic security, and to preserve economic security by adapting institutions. So framed around the ways in which aging populations threaten economic security. And the three quotes I have there are from British media. I should have said earlier on, sorry, almost all that I'm going to talk about is based on evidence from the UK. And I will, it is quite a data-intensive talk, but I'll try and show the data graphically so you can you can grasp it quickly and easily. A UK English-based talk. And these quotes are from there, again, pointing to the threats that we face as a result of aging societies. And really, my brief synopsis of how policy has responded to these challenges is twofold. One is attempts to reduce the costs of health and social care and to reduce the costs of pensions, and to do that by individualizing risk. So this is reducing public cost, not cost per se, so that we pay for these things ourselves through our own investments and so on, rather than through social investments. And the second is to promote active aging. Partly around extending working lives. If we work longer, then the cost to society of aging populations should be smaller. But also if we contribute in other ways. And here's the potential of aging populations. That aging populations can change the ways in which society is run to the good through volunteering, grandparenting, engaging in civic activities, and so on. So this kind of notion of the threats of aging, of course, fit with an idea of grand challenges as well. So inequalities as a grand challenge, but perhaps aging populations also as a grand challenge. The Commission on Global Aging also had the foresight, though, to recognize that they were not talking about a static process, that aging brings about dynamic changes to societies. And so the transformation of all spheres of social life, longer-term economic, social, and cultural dynamics as a result of aging populations. So we can't really anticipate how our societies will change as a result of aging populations, how what it is to be old will change as a result of aging populations, and how that ties in with increasing life expectancy, potentially improving health alongside increasing life expectancy, and so on. I just want to give you a sense of that, and a sense of the ways in which this is not something that's new, something that is historic. So the ways in which aging is conceived in society has changed historically as well as contemporarily. And I'm going to do that just by showing you two pictures. One is from an art gallery, the Manchester Art Gallery, a Walter Sickert painting. And I just happened to be strolling around and I saw this small picture on the stairs, and the note next to it, which I wrote down reduced a little bit. And it's interesting because the image is one that we would expect to see of an old woman. It's not a shocking image to us. But at the time it was painted, 1901-ish, contemporary critics, the notation said, I'm not an art critic, so I can't do this myself. I'm just borrowing from people who wrote about these pieces of art. Contemporary critics found this image shocking at a time when it was thought that the elderly should be represented with respect or with sentiment. Sicker instead treads a fine line between complete honesty and brutality, applying the paint in small dabs and touches so the face has the crumbling texture of great age. Faced with the reality of an aging body when we should be treating older people with respect. And then here's a contemporary image. So this is Erwin Olaf, a late baby boomer. He was born in 1959, a couple of years older than me. His art implicitly visualizes the unspoken, the overlooked, that which typically resists easy documentation. Addressing social issues, taboos, and bourgeois conventions, he conceals his themes, yet in the end, his unconventional style delivers dramatic, visual, and emotional impact. He vividly captures the essence of contemporary life. And so what you see here is in some ways an opposite image to the one that I've just shown you. Here is an active, fit, older woman dressed in sexy clothing, high heels, but set in a kind of 1960s living room. The contrast between a baby boomer now and a baby boomer as a child, in a sense. And it's the essence of a baby boomer that I think this image captures, or the essence of how we understand baby boomers that this image captures. So baby boomers, the third ages in our society. And this is a kind of reasonably contemporary notion of how we might understand baby boomers and third ages. Post-retirement, post-parenting, but pre-dependency. So these are fit people with money, with time, contributing to society, perhaps by engaging in voluntary community civic activities, consuming and enjoying life for sure, engaged in leisure and pleasure in the cultural mainstream, driving consumption, driving styles of consumption, driving fashion, engaged in self-fulfillment, having a role, but also having fun, also having status, and perhaps a generation liberated from the structured lives of previous cohorts, breaking free as they have done from their childhoods onwards. And then the kind of difficult moment when baby boomers are told that they're greedy, they're self-interested, they've benefited from social welfare unlike previous and unlike more recent generations. They're living individualized lives orientated to self-satisfaction. And this drives intergenerational conflict. And this is one of the key narratives that we're presented around aging populations at the moment, intergenerational conflict. I'm not going to explicitly address the question of intergenerational conflict, but the implication of all of my talk is that this is a misdirection. Intergenerational conflict is a misdirection. But more importantly, I think, in my context, and in my context of studying inequality, is who are these baby boomers? Who are these rich, self-interested, consuming older people? It's not all older people. Is this space open to older people? How do inequalities pattern the opportunity to be engaged in this? So I'm now going to move and talk a little bit about inequality and inequality in health and well-being, which is the primary focus of my research. I will go on to try and show how we can't understand inequality in health and well-being without understanding inequality in economics and social factors. But first off, inequalities in health and well-being. And I'm going to show you stuff that you probably know very well. Particularly if you're interested in public health. So the significance of inequalities in health and well-being in later life. And my first pictures show life expectancy, or show survival. So this is following people up over a six-year period and looking at death rates. Death rates for women on the left, death rates for men on the right. And death rates for the richest fifth of the population in the top lines of those bars, top lines of those charts, and for the poorest fifth of the population in the bottom lines of those charts. And the difference is, at least to my mind, even knowing about inequalities in health are dramatic. So for women, just about 3.5% of the richest fifth die over this six-year period, compared with something like 16 or 17% of the poorest fifth. I think, given that these are fifths of the population, these are huge differences. And for men, although the mortality rates are higher, the differences are, in relative terms, are pretty similar. hazard ratio, you'll see at the bottom, a calculated hazard ratio of the richest against the of the poorest against the richest of 1.7. Two-thirds more likely to die if you're in the poorest fifth of the population compared with the richest fifth of the population. Another way of looking at these differences in health is to just look at a snapshot at one point in time. What are the differences in health? So that followed people over time. This is a snapshot, a cross-sectional examination of differences in health. And again, it's split into wealth quintiles. So the richest fifth of the population on the left, the poorest fifth on the right of each of these clusters of bars, men on the left, women on the right, relatively young people on the left, 50 to 59, and relatively older people, 75 plus, on the right. What's important? Well, there are two important things here. One is the very clear gradient that you see that's been documented in younger life very clearly in the past, but is also present in later life. The richer you are, the lower your chance of having poor health. But also really important in this chart is that this is present at older stages as well. So it's not just young people. So if you look at the 75 pluses for both men and women, you can see very clear gradients. And the size of this difference is really very large, as these two red circles illustrate in a slightly different way. The health of the richest half of the population in the older group is pretty similar or better than the health of the poorest half of the population in the younger group. So this is a more than 15-year difference in health experience for the richest half of the population compared with the poorest half of the population. More than 15 years. Again, I think a really dramatic difference in health. These differences in health are also present in well-being. We've got an increasing interest in well-being, of course, in contemporary societies. It's not just economics, it's not just health, it's also well-being that we care about. And well-being can be conceptualized in many different ways. Here I'm just going to provide you with some very simple assessments of well-being and show you level of depression symptomatology by age for two different wealth groups. So the richest at the bottom of the chart, the poorest at the top of the chart, as you can see. And as you can see, the poorest fifth of the population have much worse well-being than the richest fifth of the population, according to this measure, but also according to all of the other measures of well-being that we use in our research. In fact, the difference is so large that when you look at the best bit of well-being for the poorest group of the population, around the ages of 65 to 75, that's still higher than for almost all of the well-being chart for the richest fifth of the population. The other interesting thing about this chart, and this is now being very well documented, is the U-shaped relationship, or the inverted U-shape if you're measuring well-being rather than depression, between age and well-being. So repeatedly documented in a number of studies using a number of different measures of well-being is that as you move from your 50s into your 60s, your well-being improves. And then as you move from your 60s into your 70s and 80s, your well-being deteriorates. It's kind of interesting to wonder what it is that results in this improvement and also in this deterioration. It's not economics. You can almost guess that from the chart I've shown you. It isn't quite an analysis of economics, but it's not economics that's driving this age relationship with well-being. It is the things that happen to you as you get older. So one thing that, so here's the U-shaped relationship again. I'm now going to try and explain this by introducing explanatory factors into the analysis. And one thing that's important is that people die, the people around you die. And so this takes into account, the darker blue line takes into account the fact that spouses die. Once you take into account the fact that spouses die, for those people whose spouses don't die, well-being remains pretty stable after the initial reduction. The other thing that's really important is your health. So if you don't become ill, your well-being improves. So these two lines, and the second line takes into account both factors, these two lines take into account the fact that as you're older, you have a greater probability of your wife dying and a greater probability of being ill. Once you get rid of those greater probabilities, you see that well-being improves with age. This is in part a longitudinal analysis. It's quite a complex analysis, but it has a longitudinal dimension to it. So this is change. as well as differences across age groups. Who becomes ill? Poorer people become iller sooner than richer people. And poorer people die sooner than richer people. So these two effects, although they appear to be potentially random, they're not random. They're distributed in the across the population in ways that increase the risk for poorer segments of the population. And the things that they might be surrogates for also change, are also correlated with being poorer. The other thing that's really interesting about these charts, if you just look at the U-shaped part of it, is why health is improving as we head into our 60s and through our 60s. What is it that improves our well-being, improves our health as we head into our 60s? And the key change that happens here is around work, of course, work and retirement. So does work and retirement explain this relationship? What is the role of paid work and retirement? And this is really important because of reforms around retirement processes and the policy desire to keep people working. So if we keep people working, do we get the promise of improved health, improved well-being, as well as the economic contribution to our societies? I'll first show you what happens in relation to changes in employment in the period before we retire. So in the 50 to 65 period for men, 50 to 60 period for women. And there are lots of transitions that can happen in relation to employment, and I've got them all here. So you can retire, you can start working, you can become employed, you can remain not working, you can stop work because you're sick, and you can stop work because you start looking after the home. And what these bars show are the change in your level of depression symptoms compared with people who stay in work. And the I bars show the confidence intervals, so the statistical probability. And if they cross the dark line, then there's no difference, of course. And if they don't cross the dark line and they're higher, it means your depression gets worse. If they're lower, it means your depression improves. And you can see that for three groups, there's significant changes. So if you remain not working, if you're unemployed and stay unemployed, if you stop work because you're ill, your depression gets worse than if you can stay working. And if you leave work and start looking after the home, your depression improves. That's a kind of interesting conundrum. I haven't tried to study that yet. It'd be interesting to try and unpick what's driving that. But for me, what were the really surprising findings were the two left-hand bars, which show that if you retire, it makes no difference to your level of depression. And we show this for other markers of well-being. And if you start working, it makes no difference to your well-being. So if you move from unemployment to work, it makes no difference to your well-being. Here, depression, but again, we've shown it for other well-being measures. Why is that? It's because these transitions are heterogeneous. There are differences according to the way you retire, differences according to the type of work you move into. And I'm going to try and show that now. I'll first show it in terms of the way you retire. I'm sorry, this chart is a little bit full. It follows the same principle as the previous one. So this is compared with people who stay working. And I've got two types of retirement here. In the darker blue are people who retire voluntarily. In the lighter blue are people who retire involuntarily. And in each case, if you go up, your well-being improves. If you go down, your well-being decreases. And you can see very consistently that for all of these measures, well-being decreases if you retire involuntarily. And for almost all of them, your well-being improves if you retire voluntarily. So retirement is a heterogeneous experience and produces heterogeneous outcomes. And the same for work. So here I've got three different health outcomes. I'm sorry, these analyses are drawn from a range of papers. And so there are different outcomes and different ways of presenting data in the talk. But here I've got depression, self-rated health, and cognitive function. Cognitive function is important here because we think keeping people in work should improve their cognitive function, or at least maintain their cognitive function. And what we show here is working after state pension age. So these are people who are men working after 65, women working after age 60 in the UK. and the change in their health compared with people who retire at state pension age. And what you can see is no difference in brief. It's again the same kind of graphic, and it shows there's no difference. But if you look at quality of work, people who continue to work in high quality work compared with people who continue to work in low quality work, people who continue to work in high quality work have an improvement in their depression, an improvement in their self-rated health. They don't have an improvement in their cognitive function. Or at least it's not statistically significant, the difference there. So again, working in later life is a heterogeneous experience. Why have I gone through this? I've gone through this because not only are these not heterogeneous experiences, the way you retire and the way you work depend upon your socioeconomic position. Your access to high quality work depends upon your socioeconomic position. Your access to voluntary retirement depends upon your socioeconomic position. So this ties back, so that U-shape ties back the process of retiring, the process of continuing to work, ties back to the inequalities that I have been talking about. So I now turn to a discussion of class and why I think class is important in terms of trying to understand these inequalities. And as I indicated earlier, I think the core issue here in relation to class is understanding the mechanisms that drive inequalities. If we study class, then we begin to understand, I believe, why socioeconomic inequalities lead to the health inequalities that we see. But studying class is difficult, and it's difficult, I think, for one empirical reason. How we measure class is controversial. There are lots of theories of class, and there are lots of approaches to measuring class. And these become even more difficult when we study older populations. So that's one reason. And the other reason is the politics of class. Once you start talking about class, you get drawn into a discussion around class conflict rather than a discussion around inequality. So I'll say again, this isn't intended to introduce a discussion of class conflict. Rather, it's intended to illustrate the mechanisms that drive inequality in later life. So, this is really a question about the theoretical and empirical approach to studying class and studying class in later life, though the lesson I think applies to studying class in other parts of the life stage. So, inequalities research, and particularly inequalities research in the tradition that I work in around health, typically operationalizes class with a measure of occupation. So, your job classified into an occupational hierarchy gives you the measure of class. Sometimes education is used, sometimes income, though typically we don't have good measures of income in health studies. What that means is that we have measures of class that reflect work, which means that almost all of the studies that are conducted are of men and sometimes women of working age. The reason we do that is because we think class gives a measure of labor position, which then gives a measure of material and psychosocial factors that are relevant to health. So how well off you are, what kind of stresses you face in your everyday lives. But we have a tradition of class studies that has been unconnected to health studies, a tradition of class studies that is now several decades old that said class isn't just about occupation and isn't just about material well-being. It's about how you live your life, and particularly about the forms of practice that give you status in life. So consumption and practice, social and cultural capital. These are significant markers of social status. And so here the narrative shifts to one just not of what you have, but also how you use it. The forms of consumption that you engage in, the kinds of social connections you have, and then what that means for your social status. So using a loosely Bourdieu approach to class, I'm arguing here that we also need to measure social, cultural practices and social status in order to understand class processes. And I'm also arguing that this is particularly important for the studies of later life, because post-retirement, markers of education and occupational class become increasingly irrelevant. So we've done a theoretically informed empirical model to try and explore some of this in relation to health and well-being. Here it is. There's no numbers in the model, just arrows. Arrows which are trying to represent significant coefficients, but significant coefficients according to the size of the effect. So red, blue, and green size of effect. I don't think you need to worry too much about the size of effect, actually. It's the theoretical point of the model. This just shows that the model empirically works, and it works for a range of health outcomes, but it's the theoretical point of the model that's important. But if we conceptualize class and education as a starting point, then we can see that it operates through employment and types of employment that people have. It operates through wealth, pensions, material circumstances, but it also operates very importantly through these set of social processes. So who we're connected to, how we're connected to people, the types of things we do, the types of cultural practices we engage in, and the kinds of health behaviors we engage in. And all of those impact on our social status. And then impact on our health and well-being. So this then allows us to begin to unpick what's important in terms of inequalities in health, how those inequalities operate, how socioeconomics drive inequalities through material, through work, but also through practice and connections. All impacting on social status and then impacting on health and well-being. And then to think about what this means in relation to policy. I just want to give you a couple of illustrations of how this actually operates, or how the middle part of this operates, and show you some effects that I think are important and quite large. And so I'll illustrate this first in relation to social, civic, and cultural participation, and how that relates to wealth. So what I have are four measures of social detachment on the left-hand side of the chart. This, again, is a snapshot, description, cross-sectional account of the relationship between wealth and being detached in these four domains. And you can see in terms of social networks on the right, wealth is completely unrelated to detachment from social networks. Very few people are actually completely detached from social networks in later life. But in relation to civic activities, leisure activities, and cultural activities, the richer you are, the less likely you are to be detached. And these differences are large. So we're talking about, in terms of civic activities, just over 60% of the poorest fifth being detached, compared with about 35% of the richest fifth being detached. Large differences. And then on the right-hand side of the chart, I show the relative risk of becoming detached over time, according to wealth, with the poorest group, the tall dark bar, being the category that the others are compared with. And you can see, if you look at furthest to the left of that group, that if you're in the richest fifth of the population, your chances of becoming detached over time are about a fifth of those in the poorest fifth of the population. Large differences. So wealth is driving those social, cultural, civic activities that are so important for health, or that I argue are so important for understanding health in later life. And I'll give you a narrative that shows you how class works. So this is from a study I did a little while back. This is a man who retired young. He retired at the age of 58. And he's interviewed 8 years after he retired. And the interview is in part about what's important to him in his life, what he values. And this is one of the things he says, or two of the things he says. So he says, sorry, I'll move around here. We travel a lot. That's the other thing I do in my spare time. I do travel talks for the local hospice for charity. I did two last week, Retired Businessman Association. I talked to them about Japan, where my daughter lived for 4 years. These are kind of experiences that we have or will have in our life courses, a professional, academic audience. I do slideshows. I did Peru on Friday, once or twice a month, have lunch or evening sessions with different groups of people. You can see the prestige and the reward he's getting from this. And you can see it also in the second quote. Country high school, I looked after modern languages for a period of time as a governor. I did a talk about the area around Avignon, had some slides. I did a talk in French, set a test. We made the subject live. I could bring something from outside the school, my expertise and the expertise of the teacher. We could make the language more interesting, more than just learning for the sake of learning. That narrative is a very middle-class narrative, of course. It's a narrative of an elite. It's a narrative that reflects how we get return and reward in our lives. It's a narrative that you don't hear from poorer working-class people, because they don't have access to the capitals that bring them these kinds of returns. So this is an illustration of, so the previous and this slide, an illustration of the importance of these social and cultural activities to our identities, to our social status, and consequently to our health and well-being. Why are these inequalities important? I know I'm running out of time. I'll try and speed up a little bit. Why are these inequalities? This might seem a kind of trite question given what I've been saying so far. Obviously, I think they're important. I want to illustrate that they're important for two reasons. One is in order to address the challenges of aging populations, and the other is the kind of social justice argument. So to address the challenges of aging populations, increasing life expectancy, we hope, is being driven also, what's driving increasing life expectancy is also driving a compression of morbidity, which basically means that as our lives extend in time, the period that we spend in illness reduces. So we have longer lives but healthier people, which reduces the burden of aging populations. And that's what this chart is attempting to show. So we have a growth over time in levels of frailty. It's a made-up chart, of course. On the blue line are people who were 70 in 2002 and 3, and in the red line, people who are 70 in 2010 and 11. And this is what we want to see: a lower level of frailty in the more recent cohort and a slower rise in frailty in the more recent cohort. That's compression of morbidity. That's a positive outcome, but it's not what happens. This is what happens. What you can see here is that the lines for the more recent cohorts are higher or at the same level than the lines for the more historic cohorts. Levels of frailty are increasing in more recent cohorts at a particular age. The lines are stacked up higher at the right-hand side of that chart. That means we have a problem. Old people are living longer, but they're living longer in poorer health. But this is driven, and I haven't shown you properly, this is driven entirely by deteriorating health of the poorest fifth of our population. It's not the poorest in our population, it's the poorest fifth. This is a relative proportion in our population. So the higher bar are the poorest, the lower bar on that call-out are the richest, and the two blue circles show where levels of frailty have increased for newer cohorts in the poorest fifth of our population. Social justice: should wealth be equally distributed? Maybe not. You could present an argument that it should not be, but should it be as skewed a distribution as we see in our population? These are survey data. Survey data exclude, of course, the richest and the poorest. The richest don't let us into their houses. The poorest don't let us into their houses and often don't have good accommodation, permanent accommodation. We don't get them. But without the poorest, you'll see that the level of wealth, so these are quintiles, and the level of wealth, deciles, and the level of wealth in the bottom four deciles is almost non-existent. The richest decile own 43% of wealth. The richest two deciles own just over 60% of wealth. The richest three deciles own 75% of wealth, excluding the extremely rich and the extremely poor. That's fine if that naturally occurs, but it doesn't naturally occur. We have fixed social mobility according to class. So here I show social mobility for different birth cohorts on the left-hand side, concentrate on the left-hand side first. This is class of origin. This is your relative chance to be in a professional or managerial class if you come from a professional or managerial background compared with those who come from semi and unskilled backgrounds. And what you see is that from the less than 1920 cohort to the 1920s cohort, there was an increase in the relative advantage of the best off. That decreased a little bit, then remained stable. We don't see social mobility. We don't see much social mobility. This is the UK, but there are similar data for other countries, including Australia. Not only do we see social mobility, there is social change. We could see social mobility. And you can see the social change for women, where the relative chance of a woman to be in a professional class compared with a man has increased, or the relative lower chance has decreased over time. Sorry, that's men compared with women. So the men's advantage has decreased over time. So this is a social injustice. The wealth inequality is a social injustice. The health inequalities that flow from that are a social injustice. So I will now summarise. maybe 2.5 minutes, but I'll see how I go. So here are my summary points. I'll go back behind the podium so I can read. So I've tried to illustrate that there are significant class and ethnic and gender inequalities that continue into later life. They aren't just present in earlier life. They remain in the older stages when people are ill. They are still present. They're present for almost all outcomes, health, psychological, social. They're shaped by later life transitions and later life circumstances. So I've shown you the wealth effects, the retirement effects, the type of work effects, the social participation effects, the volunteering effects, and so on. The mechanisms through which these inequalities operate are complex. Interrelated processes operating over time. And I tried to show you that briefly with that slightly complex but very simplified diagram. So there are processes related to material and economic position, to social and cultural capital, to employment quality and retirement processes, and to social status and identity. I've also tried to show you that this is particularly important in the context of aging populations because we see variations by cohorts. Newer cohorts have higher levels of morbidity for the poorest and widening of inequalities. If we're going to address the challenges of aging populations and dependency, we need to address these. I've also, very briefly earlier in the talk, tried to point to the important changes that are happening in the context of aging. So period changes that are reshaping later life and that have implications for inequalities. So having changes in occupational structures, changes in pension arrangements, changes in marriage and fertility patterns, and changes in digital technologies, all of which are crucial in terms of shaping inequality. And my final slide, I have one more slide after this, but not one to talk to, about policy. So I think the stuff that I'm illustrating has real significance for policies to address aging. But socioeconomic inequalities in later life are an almost absent topic in policy discussion and in policy development. We have lots of policy discussion around later life employment, around active aging, around pensions, around social care, and around welfare reform, but no consideration of inequalities in those discussions, or no meaningful consideration of inequalities in those discussions. I would argue that those discussions actually open up a space to talk about inequality and to redress inequality. So our policy is focused on notions of empowerment of older people that is really about individualization, really about productivity, individualization of risk and responsibility in the context of reduction in welfare, including pension provision. And as I've said earlier, I think there is a policy space for interventions targeted at reducing inequality and increasing social justice because there is so much going on in relation to policy in later life. So around pensions, around job quality for older people, around housing for older people, around the provision of social roles and valued identities. You think of the age-friendly movement that Ian mentioned earlier and how that can contribute to personal development, enhance social status, improve well-being and health, particularly for the poorest in our society, and reduce inequality. So I want to conclude just by saying thank you. I'm a small part in a big machine. This is just a selection of colleagues whose work I directly took for this talk. A much bigger team, and a much bigger team doing a whole set of interdisciplinary work, including biological work, genetic work, and so on. These are the people who've provided the evidence that I've shown you. And thank you to my funders, who are a cross-research council group in the UK, so ESRC, MRC, Biological Research Council, and so on. Also say thank you. You would have noticed lots of logos on my start slide. My institution, CPAR, I cheekily put that up there. I'm not sure I'm allowed to, but I did. My funder again, and the two studies that I draw most of my evidence from at the bottom. So thank you very much for listening to me.